This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. If you're a regular listener, welcome back. If you're a new listener, this is where we talk about what's going on in the world economically speaking. We talk about economic cycles and what it might mean for you and your nest egg. That said, we have a show today that I believe will give you some really important information, and we're going to give you an opportunity on today's program to order some additional free resources also. I'm going to be talking also today with special guest Mr. Carl Denninger. If you've been a longtime listener to the program, you know that Mr. Denninger is a returning guest to the program. We're going to talk to him about what's going on with Obamacare. We're going to talk to him about medical monopolies and get his take on the fact that many middle-class families now are getting paid. That means net positive cash flow to enroll in Obamacare. Might be surprising information for many of you. And then I want to talk on today's program in the second and the fourth segments about the whole idea of deflation. You know, with all the money printing that's taken place over the past several years by the Federal Reserve, one of the big concerns that a lot of folks have is inflation. However, on today's program, I'm going to share with you a lot of evidence from all around the world that in spite of all the money printing that's taken place by the Federal Reserve in the United States, the Bank of England, the Bank of China, that deflation remains the biggest threat. And the biggest thing to remember about deflation is that stocks and stock mutual funds typically don't like deflation. So we'll talk about that in the second and the fourth segment of today's program. I'll also give you an opportunity now, if you'd like, to go and request our free Investors Discovery Kit. All you have to do to get that is visit investingapproach.com. And when you do, and let us know where to mail your kit, we'll be glad to send you a copy of the book, New Retirement Rules, the New Economy Magazine, as well as an educational CD and DVD. Again, the website to visit to get all that information sent to you free of charge with no obligation is investingapproach.com. Here at Everything Financial, we are always concerned about education and getting you more information that will hopefully be relevant to you when it comes to managing your nest egg. Again, the website, investingapproach.com. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program one of my favorite guests. He's been a frequent guest here, Mr. Carl Denninger. You can read Carl's blog at market-ticker.org. He is a prolific writer as well as a political and economic commentator. So, Mr. Denninger, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's talk about what's going on over in China, Carl. We have talked for a long time here on the program with you and other guests that certainly China's economy looks like it's bubbling. And is it true that, or does it seem, based on what's coming out of China, the news we're seeing, that China's ready to implode?
I think China is potentially trying to stave off a shift that is coming from a number of different sectors, none of which they'll be successful at mitigating. The recent rate cut is in response to both a slowdown in economic growth. Of course, you know, China aims for a 9-10% growth number, which is insane. But in addition to the bottlenecking, if you will, of highly leveraged financial deals, and those, as we discovered in 2007 and 2008 here in the United States, are taking time bombs. So there's a lot of so-called guaranteed products over there that really aren't, because the people who made the guarantees can't pay, just like we had over here with AIG. And this latest rate cut appears to be an attempt to prevent an unwind from starting in that marketplace, along with generally supposedly stimulating demand. I don't think it's going to do either. And frankly, the shift that's coming in China is being driven by production cost increases, which they can try to mitigate to a small extent for a short while, but ultimately they're going to shoot themselves in the foot, because they built their mercantilism on polluting the land and water and cheap labor, and all of those advantages are over time going away.
So, Carl, for our listeners that may not be familiar with this rate cut, just bring them up to speed. What's the news?
Well, the rate cut is essentially an attempt by the central bank to cut borrowing costs in China. And that's the Chinese central bank rather than our Fed. And so it has the same sort of impact, or so they believe, as does the Fed cutting rates. But what you really got here is a pyramid of collateral, just like we had here in the United States prior to the crash. And that isn't stimulated by cutting rates. All you do is layer on more risk when you do that sort of thing. So the real solution is to unwind those instruments. But if you do that, the people who made those loans go bankrupt because they can't pay in. The guarantees aren't any good. And that would lead to an economic crash over in China, just like it was leading to here in the United States. So this is the same sort of response cycle that you see in all countries when this kind of thing gets going. But China has a property bubble that is arguably larger than the one we had here in the U.S. prior to our housing crash, and it's everywhere.
So, Carl, when you use the term highly leveraged financial instrument or highly leveraged financial deals, I know we have listeners out there that maybe are a little bit confused as to what exactly that means. Can you give just maybe an example of what that product might look like and kind of give a one-on-one explanation?
Well, a highly leveraged deal is simply one where somebody has written a guarantee that a particular loan will perform that would otherwise potentially not, and gets paid a small amount of money for this guarantee. This allows the institution that wrote the loan or that is carrying the loan to claim that its paper has no risk. Because if something goes wrong with that loan, then the person who made the guarantee would have to pay. The problem with these sorts of instruments is that unless the person who writes the guarantee actually has the money, then what you bought is worthless. And so banks and other institutions, both in the United States and in China, use these kinds of instruments in order to claim that they can lend out money when their assets are allegedly safe because they don't have to cover these bad loans that they potentially have made. The problem with these guarantees is that the people who wrote them cannot make the payments. This is what happened with AIG. AIG wrote $500 billion worth of these guarantees, but they didn't have any money.
Carl, how will what investors are going to get hurt when this eventually unwinds? Or will the Chinese government do what the United States government did and say, okay, we've got to step in and we've got to save the financial system?
Well, the Chinese government can't do it the way that the U.S. government did. Remember, the United States federal government, when it began playing its games with the Federal Reserve and deficit spending, had an international market willing to buy its bonds to absorb that supply. Where are the Chinese going to sell theirs?
Great point. So how is the Chinese economy ultimately affected, and what will be the fallout in the United States and around the world?
Ultimately, what likely happens is the Chinese currency becomes much weaker. This makes their imports, things that they need to import, much more expensive. This is, I believe, one of the reasons they're so keen to get a pipeline going to Russia, or another one anyway. They already have one going. They want the second one, the eastern route, and to stabilize their energy supplies, because China's problem in the present tense is that behind every unit of economic output is a unit of energy. Well, cleaning up energy production is hideously expensive as well. So you're adding two things to the expense side of the sheet. One is that you have to import all of this energy that you wish to consume. And the second is that you have to clean up the emissions in order to prevent polluting your land and water. And so you've cranked up the cost side of the equation. Well, how does that help anything when the entire reason that you have an economy that works is because you're exporting cheap goods to other parts of the world?
So this has a kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, if your imports become more expensive, isn't it good for exports? Doesn't that balance out?
Well, it's good up to a point, but there's the problem that comes from this is that you have to produce the goods and services before you can export them, and your people have to eat. And what happens when you can't feed your own people and you have to import food as well?
Well, and certainly when you look at what's happened in Japan, the weak yen policy, certainly you've seen the cost of food and fuel skyrocket there. So certainly we might see much the same happen in China. Would you agree?
Yes, and the difference is that in China you have a huge percentage of the population that still essentially lives at subsistence level, which is not true in Japan. This is a recipe for serious civil instability of various forms.
Well, Carl, we are coming up on the end of this segment. We're going to talk to you about Obamacare and some of the developments that have taken place there now that we have enrollment going on again. Briefly, as we go to break, let the listeners learn about how they can discover more about what you do.
Well, they can read market-ticker.org, which is my daily commentary on what's going on. And there's a rather long presentation on the second part of this that is there as well. It's about 20 minutes.
Terrific. Well, we will continue our conversation with Carl Denninger when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I'll continue my conversation with today's special guest, Mr. Carl Denninger, in the next segment. You know, on today's program, I want to explore a little discussed issue. In fact, it's being ignored by much of the media, and that issue is deflation. When you read the headlines, there's a lot of concerns about inflation, given that in particular, the Federal Reserve here in the United States has printed a lot of money. They've now since stopped that. Many other central banks around the world are also printing money. And this expansion of the money supply, or what seems to be or should be by all logic, an expansion of the money supply, might lead to inflation. Now, in my book, New Retirement Rules, and you can get a copy of the book as well as a copy of the New Economy magazine, as well as an educational CD and DVD by visiting the website investingapproach.com. If you visit the website investingapproach.com and let us know where you'd like us to mail your investor's discovery kit, you'll get a copy of the book, the magazine, the CD, and the DVD. Rest assured, we do not share that information with anyone. You'll just get the free resources. Now, in that book, I talk about the definition of inflation as being an expansion of the money supply. Now, a lot of people would define inflation as rising prices, but that can be a symptom of inflation. The textbook definition of inflation is the expansion of the money supply. Now, the polar opposite of inflation is deflation. Deflation is a contraction of the money supply. And the symptoms of deflation are falling wages, falling prices, and many times falling stocks, as stocks don't like deflation. Now, there are two things that are fundamental to understanding this. Number one, the money supply expands and creates inflation when money moves. Now, if you want to get a good definition of this, all you need to do is go to the New York Federal Reserve Bank's website, and there's a definition there of the fractionalized banking system. See, today, according to banking rules, when you go put money in your bank in the form of a deposit, your banker is required to keep on deposit or in reserve only 10% of that amount. So if you go put $1,000 into your bank, your banker is required to reserve $100, but the other $900, your banker is free to loan out. Well, when money is moving, when people are borrowing money and banks are loaning money, and money moves at full speed, or an economist might say full velocity, $1,000 in one bank, I should say $1,000 deposited into one bank, can expand into $10,000. So on the fractionalized banking system, as money moves, more money is created. Well, key point number one is that money is not moving. Folks are not in a big hurry to borrow money, given that private sector debt levels are near record highs. And when measured as a percentage of the economy, private sector debt levels today are 50% higher than they were at the beginning of the Great Depression. Folks are not in a big hurry to borrow money. In fact, if you can't afford another payment, it really doesn't matter how low interest rates are. Now, the second key point, the second thing that you need to understand is fundamental to understanding what's going on in all economies around the world, is that the money supply contracts when debt doesn't get paid. I just mentioned that private sector debt levels were at all-time highs, and there's a fundamental economic truth that says if there's too much debt to be paid, it will not all be paid. That's not rocket science. If there's too much debt to be paid, it won't all get paid. If you think back to when Detroit, the city of Detroit, first declared bankruptcy, I talked here on the program about the fact that it really didn't matter if federal law trumped state law or state law trumped federal law. The eternal truth was people were going to get pension cuts because there just simply wasn't enough money in the checkbook to make the payments. That's exactly what happened. Well, just so you understand this completely, the money supply contracts when debt does not get paid. Think about the fact that maybe you would loan someone some money. Let's just say you had $50,000 cash under your mattress, and you had a relative come to you and say, I need to borrow $50,000, and I'll give you my car as collateral. Wanting to help out your relative, you take the $50,000 cash from underneath your mattress, you loan it to your relative, expecting to get paid back. That $50,000 asset went from being a cash asset to a note receivable, but it's still a $50,000 asset. Now let's say a couple months pass and your relative comes to you and says, thanks for the loan, but there's no way I can repay it. Here's the title to my car. You take the car and go sell it and get $20,000 for the car. You take $20,000 cash that you get from selling the car and you put that $20,000 cash back under your mattress. What happened to the other $30,000? It went to what we call money heaven. The money supply just contracted by $30,000. Now, if you take that scenario and take private sector debt levels and extrapolate that across the entire economy, you see that a lot of money is disappearing from the system. A lot of money is going to money heaven because private sector debt levels are at all-time highs. Now, inflation, as I said, is most discussed as a potential economic problem, but deflation is not discussed all that much. And one of the effects of deflation that may really affect you and your money that you should be aware of is the fact that stocks don't like deflation. Now, we're going to explore this even more later in the program today, but let me just go back and give you a bit from an interview that was conducted by the Gold Report. This was conducted with prior guest here on the Everything Financial Radio program, best-selling author Harry Dent. Mr. Dent wrote a book called The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. Now, he was asked if he was surprised by the strong stock market over the last year, and here was Mr. Dent's response. He said, yes, I was. I'm always surprised. Bubbles go and go until they suck everybody in. It's been this way throughout history. This is a bubble. It looks like a bubble, quacks like a bubble, and tracks every bubble in history. It's going to burst, but we continue to have outside influences propping it up. The Federal Reserve announced tapering of quantitative easing, but then the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank stepped up their bond buying, which is essentially more quantitative easing, and the markets are eating it up. He said regarding the markets, before deflation kicks in and the market corrects, he thinks that the markets will probably not peak until early next year, perhaps around March. He said the Dow could get as high as 19,000 in his view. However, he said this market, when it corrects, is not going to crash 10 or 20%. It's going to crash worse than it did in 2008 and 2001 and 1930 and 1973. This is going to be the biggest crash ever. Mr. Dent comes to that conclusion because debt levels are high and there's going to have to be a major reset. Debt bubbles do require a reset, and resets are painful. I'll talk about this more later in the program. However, let me again remind you that if you've not yet gotten our free Investor's Discovery Kit, which talks about inflation, deflation, and how deflation might affect your nest egg, I'd invite you to do so by visiting investingapproach.com. The website is investingapproach.com. Just let us know where you'd like us to mail your free kit. We'll be glad to do that. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Money, money, money. Always sunny in the rich man's world. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure today of chatting with Mr. Carl Denninger. You can read Carl's blog at market-ticker.org. I would encourage you to check it out. And Carl, as we're recording this, you just recently wrote a rather lengthy piece on Obamacare. And you taught me a couple things in that piece, and I'd like you to maybe share a bit in this segment with what you wrote in your blog. Let's just start with Obamacare and the fact that there is an enrollment period going on now. Since Obamacare has become law, give us your opinion as to good, bad, ugly, otherwise, and bring us up to speed.
Well, let's start with what it means for the average middle-class and lower-middle-class American, because these are the people who, in general, get the benefit, okay? If you're very poor, you are on Medicaid already, and that eligibility has been expanded to some extent, so it helps those people a little bit as well. But if you were middle-class, or are today, you are in a rather interesting position, because the problem that we have from a budgetary perspective, both personally and at a state, federal, and local level, is medical monopolies. And that's the posting that you refer to. It's actually a video presentation. It takes about 20 minutes to go through. And what we have allowed to happen is for the medical system to essentially circumvent and get around the Sherman and Clayton Acts, which are supposed to prevent monopoly behavior. In fact, it's supposed to make it a felony. So we have built a medical system in this country that operates much like the old oil barons back before those acts were passed. And that's great if you happen to be one of those people. It's terrible if you're anybody else. But what Obamacare has done is for people in the lower part of that area of income, it has allowed them to buy, for the first time in 20 years, what amounts to catastrophic medical insurance for about the price of their car insurance. Now, that's actually quite good, if you think about it. But you say, well, how can that happen? And the answer is, all of those people who make a lot of money, or who make more than the thresholds for the subsidies, specifically, which is about 400% of the federal poverty level, you're going to be paying for that inaction that you engaged in, and that you didn't put a stop to, and that we all collectively allowed to happen with Obamacare. You're not only going to pay for it for yourself, you're going to pay for it for all of those people who are in the middle class. Because you're the one who's going to pay the higher taxes and suffer the currency depreciation so that people can have those catastrophic policies at a reasonable price.
So, Carl, let me go back and have you revisit something you said, that we've got what would be the equivalent of a monopoly in the medical industry. Expand on that, would you please?
Sure. I'll just pick one or two examples real quickly. There was a lady who was written up in the paper a few months ago. I think it was back towards the beginning of the year. It may have been last year, actually. Got bit by a scorpion, got stung out in the Phoenix area, and she needed scorpion antivenom because she was allergic to the sting. Well, this antivenom is made in Mexico. You can buy it in Mexico over the counter. It costs $100 per vial. Now, she needed two vials in order to counteract the effects of the sting. She went to the hospital, they gave it to her, and they charged her $60,000. Now, Phoenix is not very far away from Mexico. And yet, if you or I were to get in our car and drive into Mexico and buy a trunk load of this antivenom and bring it back into the United States, we'd go to prison because it is against the law for me to resell that which I own, because I'm not an approved person to distribute and vend this stuff. So who got a law passed that said that what I own I can't do with as I wish, including sell it at a reasonable profit? If that law didn't exist, that antivenom would probably cost $150 a vial instead of $30,000. It is the same situation that allows a pharmaceutical company in this country to decide that a hepatitis C cure, which was just recently approved by the FDA, will be priced based upon the GDP of the country where it's sold. Now, that could never be upheld if you could buy it in one country and get on a plane and take it to another, because you would have competition between providers and the price would collapse. So this sort of thing exists all throughout the medical system, not just in the pharmaceutical area, but also in procedures and devices. You can have an MRI done on pretty much any part of your body in Japan for a couple hundred dollars. In the United States, it costs a couple of thousand dollars. Japan is not a third world country, and yet you can have these procedures done for a tenth of the price as you have to pay here in the United States. And it is only because we restrain trade, we allow that to take place, that this occurs. 15 United States Code, the Sherman and Clayton Acts, makes that illegal, but the medical industry has gotten myriad exemptions to that law passed for their own benefit and those of the insurance firms. And that's why this happens.
Carl, it strikes me when you throw those numbers out, and those stories are absolutely astonishing, and it's amazing that something like that is allowed to occur. But what kind of drag is this on the U.S. economy? This is, I mean, it's great for the medical sector, but just think about if those dollars were going somewhere else.
Well, that's exactly the problem, Dennis, is that what we have taken is we've taken a part of the economy that formerly was a low single-digit percentage of the whole and turned it into something that consumes almost $1.05. Now, if you're one of the beneficiaries of this because you live where you otherwise would have died, that sounds really great. But the problem is it adds about 18%, that percentage of GDP, to the cost of everything produced in the country. That makes us terribly uncompetitive on the world markets because nobody else allows us to go on. So we have a massive misallocation of resource in the United States, which creates all sorts of problems for the producers of goods and services within this nation. And Obamacare was sold as a way to help ease that pain for the individual, but it does absolutely nothing to resolve the problem. And the reason's quite simple. You have both sides of the aisle that are beholden to this business, which I liken to a racket. And until something is done about it and it's stopped, we're not going to see this problem go away.
Well, and Carl, arguably, when you look at bang for the buck, the medical industry doesn't treat anything very effectively either, other than they charge a lot better than they get results. At least that's my view. So let me ask you this. There's an economist, a late economist by the name of Herbert Stein, who said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. We can't continue to have medical costs consume an ever greater share of the economy. What, if anything, turns this trend around?
I think the trend comes to an end when we have enough pain within the economic picture of the average American that they put their foot down and demand that it stop. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that as an American today, if you're in the middle class, you can reduce your income to the point that you escape most of this cost. Of course, there's adverse selection problem that comes from this, and that if everybody does that, there's no money to pay for it, right? Because the money to pay those subsidies has to come from somebody. So there is a pain point at which the politicians are forced to stand up and do something about it. But the people have to get sufficiently angry and be willing to put their foot down, and until that happens, you're not going to see this change.
Well, Carl, certainly when you look at what happened in the midterm elections, it seems like voters maybe did try to put their foot down, but with only, about a third of all eligible voters actually voting, it seems like there's a lot of apathy out there, that a lot of people really don't care. As long as they're getting their check and it doesn't disturb their lifestyle, they're happy. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, but what people have to understand is it will disturb their lifestyle because you are paying more for everything you buy that is made in the United States, and believe it or not, an awful lot of services are provided in the United States, whether you like it or not. You are paying every year through currency devaluation, which is occasioned by the Fed's zero interest rate policy. And none of these things are going to change until the people stand up and say, we've had enough of this.
You know, Carl, I want to just change subjects here a little bit in the few minutes we have left, because when you talk about Fed policy and 0% interest, did you see the Fed printing again, or quantitative easing, whatever they call it? How do you see Fed policy evolving from this point?
I don't think the Fed stopped quantitative easing because they wanted to or because the economy was improving. I think they did it because of bond portfolio duration problems within the fixed income market. They were forced to, and for that reason, I don't think they'll go back to it.
So what will be the economic outcomes? Will we now see deflation kick in, given that there's still a massive amount of private sector debt?
I think at some point, defaulting of that debt is going to be necessary. But whether or not that leads to a massive deflationary surge is an uncertain thing. My suspicion is what we're going to see is something much like what happened in Japan, where you essentially have disinflation, where there's just none because there's none that can take hold. The Fed is trapped at the zero boundary because the federal interest burden, should rates rise, becomes enough to bankrupt the federal government. And so they've got themselves a devil of a problem, because what is their answer to this? If you raise rates, then the federal government gets in trouble. And yet if you don't raise rates, then, you know, how does the economy ever start to grow?
Well, and Carl, I guess last topic, how is the U.S. stock market, which is at all-time nominal highs anyway, arguably not real highs, but nominal highs, how will the stock market be affected if the Fed doesn't continue to print, if they stop? Are we going to see a big correction?
What the Fed's done at this point is make for a short-term bubble mentality in the stock market that has really gotten out of control, because corporations have gone out and borrowed money to buy back shares. Well, that increases their earnings per share, but remember that this is a two-edged sword. When those companies have to roll that debt over, and that debt has service costs that go on a forward basis, it's going to mean that you have losses per share that are larger than they would otherwise be as well. So when the EPS number goes negative, it's not going to be good at all.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Carl Denninger. You can read Carl's blog at market-ticker.org. I would encourage you to do that. Carl, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure today of chatting with Mr. Carl Denninger. You can read Carl's blog at market-ticker.org. I would encourage you to check it out. And Carl, as we're recording this, you just recently wrote a rather lengthy piece on Obamacare. And you taught me a couple things in that piece, and I'd like you to maybe share a bit in this segment with what you wrote in your blog. Let's just start with Obamacare and the fact that there is an enrollment period going on now. Since Obamacare has become law, give us your opinion as to good, bad, ugly, otherwise, and bring us up to speed.
Well, let's start with what it means for the average middle class and lower middle class American, because these are the people who, in general, get the benefit. Okay? If you're very poor, you are on Medicaid already, and that eligibility has been expanded to some extent, so it helps those people a little bit as well. But if you were middle class, or are today, you are in a rather interesting position, because the problem that we have from a budgetary perspective, both personally and at a state, federal, and local level, is medical monopolies. And that's the posting that you refer to. It's actually a video presentation. It takes about 20 minutes to go through. And what we have allowed to happen is for the medical system to essentially circumvent and get around the Sherman and Clayton Acts, which are supposed to prevent monopoly behavior. In fact, it's supposed to make it a felony. So we have built a medical system in this country that operates much like the old oil barons back before those acts were passed. And that's great if you happen to be one of those people. It's terrible if you're anybody else. But what Obamacare has done is, for people in the lower part of that area of income, it has allowed them to buy, for the first time in 20 years, what amounts to catastrophic medical insurance for about the price of their car insurance. Now, that's actually quite good, if you think about it. But you say, well, how can that happen? And the answer is, all of those people who make a lot of money, or who make more than the thresholds for the subsidies, specifically, which is about 400% of the federal poverty level, you're going to be paying for that inaction that you engaged in and that you didn't put a stop to, and that we all collectively allowed to happen with Obamacare. You're not only going to pay for it for yourself, you're going to pay for it for all of those people who are in the middle class. Because you're the one who's going to pay the higher taxes and suffer the currency depreciation so that people can have those catastrophic policies at a reasonable price.
So, Carl, let me go back and have you revisit something you said, that we've got what would be the equivalent of a monopoly in the medical industry. Expand on that, would you please?
Sure. I'll just pick one or two examples real quickly. There was a lady who was written up in the paper a few months ago. I think it was back towards the beginning of the year. It may have been last year, actually. Got bit by a scorpion, got stung out in the Phoenix area. And she needed scorpion antivenom because she was allergic to the sting. Well, this antivenom is made in Mexico. You can buy it in Mexico over the counter. Costs $100 per vial. Now, she needed two vials in order to counteract the effects of the sting. She went to the hospital, they gave it to her, and they charged her $60,000. Now, Phoenix is not very far away from Mexico. And yet, if you or I were to get in our car and drive into Mexico and buy a trunk load of this antivenom and bring it back into the United States, we'd go to prison because it is against the law for me to resell that which I own, because I'm not an approved person to distribute and vend this stuff. So who got a law passed that said that what I own I can't do with as I wish, including sell it at a reasonable profit? If that law didn't exist, that antivenom would probably cost $150 a vial instead of $30,000. It is the same situation that allows a pharmaceutical company in this country to decide that a hepatitis C cure, which was just recently approved by the FDA, will be priced based upon the GDP of the country where it's sold. Now, that could never be upheld if you could buy it in one country and get on a plane and take it to another, because you would have competition between providers and the price would collapse. So this sort of thing exists all throughout the medical system, not just in the pharmaceutical area, but also in procedures and devices. You can have an MRI done on pretty much any part of your body in Japan for a couple hundred dollars. In the United States, it costs a couple of $1,000s. Japan is not a third world country, and yet you can have these procedures done for a tenth of the price as you have to pay here in the United States. And it is only because we restrain trade, we allow that to take place, that this occurs. 15 United States Code, the Sherman and Clayton Acts, makes that illegal, but the medical industry has gotten myriad exemptions to that law passed for their own benefit and those of the insurance firms. And that's why this happens.
Carl, it strikes me when you throw those numbers out, and those stories are absolutely astonishing, and it's amazing that something like that is allowed to occur. But what kind of drag is this on the U.S. economy? This is, I mean, it's great for the medical sector, but just think about if those dollars were going somewhere else.
Well, that's exactly the problem, Dennis, is that what we have taken is we've taken a part of the economy that formerly was a low single-digit percentage of the whole and turned it into something that consumes almost $1.05. Now, if you're one of the beneficiaries of this because you live where you otherwise would have died, that sounds really great. But the problem is it adds about 18%, that percentage of GDP, to the cost of everything produced in the country. That makes us terribly uncompetitive on the world markets because nobody else allows us to go on. So we have a massive misallocation of resource in the United States, which creates all sorts of problems for the producers of goods and services within this nation. And Obamacare was sold as a way to help ease that pain for the individual, but it does absolutely nothing to resolve the problem. And the reason's quite simple. You have both sides of the aisle that are beholden to this business, which I liken to a racket, And until something is done about it and it's stopped, we're not going to see this problem go away.
Well, and Carl, arguably, when you look at bang for the buck, the medical industry doesn't treat anything very effectively either, other than they charge a lot better than they get results. At least that's my view. So let me ask you this. There's an economist, a late economist by the name of Herbert Stein, who said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. We can't continue to have medical costs consume an ever greater share of the economy. What, if anything, turns this trend around?
I think the trend comes to an end when we have enough pain within the economic picture of the average American that they put their foot down and demand that it stop. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that as an American today, if you're in the middle class, you can reduce your income to the point that you escape most of this cost. Of course, there's adverse selection problem that comes from this, and that if everybody does that, there's no money to pay for it, right? Because the money to pay those subsidies has to come from somebody. So there is a pain point at which the politicians are forced to stand up and do something about it. But the people have to get sufficiently angry and be willing to put their foot down, and until that happens, you're not going to see this change.
Well, Carl, certainly when you look at what happened in the midterm elections, it seems like voters maybe did try to put their foot down, but with only, about a third of all eligible voters actually voting, it seems like there's a lot of apathy out there, that a lot of people really don't care. As long as they're getting their check and it doesn't disturb their lifestyle, they're happy. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, but what people have to understand is it will disturb their lifestyle because you are paying more for everything you buy that is made in the United States, and believe it or not, an awful lot of services are provided in the United States, whether you like it or not. You are paying every year through currency devaluation, which is occasioned by the Fed's zero interest rate policy. And none of these things are going to change until the people stand up and say, we've had enough of this.
You know, Carl, I want to just change subjects here a little bit in the few minutes we have left, because when you talk about Fed policy and 0% interest, did you see the Fed printing again, or quantitative easing, whatever they call it? How do you see Fed policy evolving from this point?
I don't think the Fed stopped quantitative easing because they wanted to or because the economy was improving. I think they did it because of bond portfolio duration problems within the fixed income market. They were forced to, and for that reason, I don't think they'll go back to it.
So what will be the economic outcomes? Will we now see deflation kick in, given that there's still a massive amount of private sector debt?
I think at some point, defaulting of that debt is going to be necessary. But whether or not that leads to a massive deflationary surge is an uncertain thing. My suspicion is what we're going to see is something much like what happened in Japan, where you essentially have disinflation, where there's just none because there's none that can take hold. The Fed is trapped at the zero boundary because the federal interest burden, should rates rise, becomes enough to bankrupt the federal government. And so they've got themselves a devil of a problem, because what is their answer to this? If you raise rates, then the federal government gets in trouble. And yet if you don't raise rates, then, how does the economy ever start to grow?
Well, and Carl, I guess last topic, how is the U.S. stock market, which is at all-time nominal highs anyway, arguably not real highs, but nominal highs, how will the stock market be affected if the Fed doesn't continue to print, if they stop? Are we going to see a big correction?
What the Fed's done at this point is make for a short-term bubble mentality in the stock market that has really gotten out of control, because corporations have gone out and borrowed money to buy back shares. Well, that increases their earnings per share, but remember that this is a two-edged sword. When those companies have to roll that debt over, and that debt has service costs that go on a forward basis, it's going to mean that you have losses per share that are larger than they would otherwise be as well. So when the EPS number goes negative, it's not going to be good at all.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Carl Denninger. You can read Carl's blog at market-ticker.org. I would encourage you to do that. Carl, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words.